Anthropology today, it is far more than the world of Margaret Mead or Indiana Jones. The field of anthropology is broad and varied. Forensic anthropologists, for example, help solve crimes, while corporate anthropologists help companies run better. There are anthropologists who study refugees, climate change, violence, hospitals, food systems, and more. Their projects can inform big policy debates and decisions, whether about war or the environment. But anthropology is often misunderstood. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk with three anthropologists working and teaching in Maine. We'll learn about their fields of inquiry, from a local research project focusing on Maine's culture of reuse to fieldwork in Africa focusing on Boko Haram. Maine Calling delves into the field of anthropology and what it has to do with our daily lives next. But first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. We've all heard of anthropology, and we may have a sense of what an anthropologist does, but today we're going to hear from some Maine anthropologists about the work that they do and how it can and does matter to our everyday lives. In the studio with me, Cindy Eisenhower. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology and Climate Change Institute at the University of Maine. Nadia El-Sharari is an assistant professor of global studies at Colby College. She is a cultural and medical anthropologist whose research focuses on refugees, mental health, and humanitarianism in the Middle East and North Africa and Europe. Scott McEachern is also with us. He is a professor of anthropology at Bowdoin College. His new book is Searching for Boko Haram, A History of Violence in Central America. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about the work anthropologists do or what they study? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Just talking about what the three of you all focus on gives a little bit of a sense of how varied and broad this field is. And so it's going to be really fun to delve into that. And I want to ask all three of you first, though. And Cindy, I'll start with you. How did you first get interested in anthropology? Is this something you knew you wanted to be since you were a little girl? Or was there a moment?
No, absolutely not. It couldn't be further from that, actually. I had a career before becoming an anthropologist in marketing.
Really?
I did. I was really interested in consumer culture. And as I began to grow intellectually and think a bit more reflexively about the social and environmental consequences of our consumer culture, I decided that I wanted to go back to school and study anthropology to really understand the cultural construction of our mass consumer culture and to think about where it came from rather than just something that is.
Isn't that interesting? How long were you out into the real world before you went back into academia?
About 3 years after undergrad.
Oh, wow.
I worked in an ad agency and then a PR agency and then went back.
Had you studied anthropology as an undergrad?
I had not had a single class.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
That really is. Okay, Scott, top that story. How'd you get interested in anthropology?
Oh, I think I probably was interested at a much earlier age. I always wanted to be an archaeologist when I was a kid. And the issue is, you know, I grew up on a farm on Prince Edward Island in Atlantic Canada, so the possibilities for doing archaeology seemed to be a little remote. And I ended up going to university and grad school, and I had a professor who included me on a project in Central Africa. I was over there for the first time when I was 21, and I've been going back there ever since. So I've been doing archaeology in south of Lake Chad, in Cameroon, Nigeria, Chad, for over 30 years now.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you a question I was going to ask a little later on, though. You say doing archaeology, but you're an anthropologist. What is the intersection or the difference?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, and it just illustrates, as you said, how broad the discipline actually is. We usually think of anthropology as having four subdisciplines: cultural anthropology, linguistics, archaeology, and biological or physical anthropology. So I do one of the subdisciplines. It's often called a four-field discipline. And what I do essentially is I look at the same sort of topics of societies and cultures that these folks look at, except I look at them in the past.
Mm-hmm. And Cindy, would you say you're a cultural anthropologist?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. So Nadia, your turn. How did you get interested?
Well, I'm going to split the difference, actually, between these two, because I, like many people, I think, didn't know that anthropology existed until I got to undergraduate. Just finished teaching an intro class at Colby, and it's fun to see students come in, and they don't know anything about the discipline at all. So when I started to take anthropology as an undergraduate, I was particularly drawn to medical anthropology. At the time, I had very close friends and family members dealing with health issues, and I had no idea there was this whole field that looked just at the social and cultural dimensions of illness and healing systems. And so finding this other way into issues that I cared about very much personally, for me, was just this whole sort of world opening, that there was a way you could learn about how health and illness affected people's lives that didn't involve necessarily becoming a doctor. And that's when I really sort of fell in love with the subject.
Wow. And so I love the idea that you teach those same kinds of undergrads that you were. Are the young people at Colby who are taking your class, are they taking it just to kind of check off a requirement and have no idea what they're in for?
Well, at the intro level, some of them very much are. So some of them have, you know, very, very few have had some anthropology in high school, but the vast majority are taking it because it fulfills a particular kind of general education requirement. And so it's a really wonderful opportunity from a teaching point of view to kind of open up the particular kind of lens that anthropology can give us into seeing the world in a different kind of way to students for the first time. It's really, it's lots of fun.
I think many people are familiar with the work of Margaret Mead. Is she possibly the most famous anthropologist, especially sort of brought back to life by the fiction by Lily King, Euphoria, which is sort of loosely based on parts of her life. Is that a good or a bad thing to have people think of anthropologists as people who go away and study, you know, cultures that are sort of separated from the rest of human society and doing something that's really exotic? And so anybody can jump in. What do anthropologists think of this sort of, I don't want to say stereotype because she was a real person who did really important work, but this assumption, I guess.
Sure. I think it's both a good and a bad thing. So there has been this tradition in anthropology about going out and seeing the exotic other, which is really important in some ways because it helps us to think in a completely different way about our own lives and about how we behave in the way that we do. So we can see things that are very radically different than our own lives. And it helps us to understand that we are, as humans, both very similar to one another, but also very different. And we can then interrogate why is it that in some places things are so different than they are and what we're used to. So it allows us to question these, you know, kind of ideas about a common human, natural, innate, inevitable behavior. On the other side, I think anthropology, unfortunately for all too long, did forget to study ourselves also, to understand the people at home and to also see us as part of this vast array of cultural difference and similarity. So it's I'd say it's both good and bad. But Margaret Mead certainly is, I think you're right, one of the people that folks are most likely to identify with or to ask us if we're like Indiana Jones.
Yeah, Indiana Jones, and also somebody told me that Bones, the forensic anthropology on the, and I did a quick Google search, and there are whole articles written about what's right and what's not right on Bones. Yeah, a lot not right, but still, at least somebody's heard the phrase forensic anthropologist. Scott, do you look at the world, and I want to ask the rest of you this as well, differently? Are you sitting, when you go to a party, are you observing how people behave, or are you able to take off your anthropology? Had and
I take it off fairly easily, I think. You know, my experience is I've always worked overseas, so I'm one of the folks who does go away
and, to exotic places.
It's less exotic after you work there for 35 years, as Cindy said, what I'm trying to do when I write about it or when I talk about the area I work in, which most people would at first glance think is very, very exotic, is I'm trying to make, there's an old sort of anthropological saying about make the strange familiar and the familiar strange. I want to make, I want to make these people comprehensible and entirely human to the folks who may read a book like Searching for Boko Haram.
Okay, and I want to ask each of you individually about your research, but Nadia, give you a chance to answer that question. Do you think you see people and see everyday life a little differently because of your field of study?
I think I do. I mean, I agree with Scott that it's definitely something you can turn on and off. But I would say that the kind of skills that and the sort of lens that we learn as anthropologists definitely help when you find yourself in a situation where you might, in any kind of everyday life, where you might feel that something is natural and that there's a certain right way to do things. Having that ability to see, actually, there's this huge variation in the ways in which humans organize themselves and the ways in which humans live, is a wonderful thing to be able to bring into moments where one is personally feeling discomfort or personally feeling that they're in an unfamiliar setting. So I definitely find myself drawing on it at various moments.
And you, Cindy?
Yeah, I think it's the anthropological perspective is really useful. And I agree, I can turn it on and off. But I think I do, you know, even just thinking about like a dinner party or an everyday situation that many of us would take for granted, I think the anthropological perspective allows us to, like, if we were fish, to feel the water, right? Or if we're humans, to feel the air, right? What is it that's kind of around us? And it helps us to think about things in more critical ways. How did, for example, waste become waste? How did, for example, these ideas about class make their way into this conversation? So that's really useful. And I also think it's great, too, in the anthropological perspective, encouraging us to understand things from other people's perspectives. It's really a great tool to be able to understand, to try to understand the situational rationality that someone's coming from and understand maybe how their perspective was formed through time.
Okay, so we talked about your book just very briefly, Scott, Searching for Boko Haram, A History of Violence in Central Africa. I have to think that you started this work and you started this book before the really terrible kidnapping of all those girls.
No, actually, I started it just a couple of years ago.
And okay.
The reason I did it is because I work precisely where Boko Haram operates. That kidnapping at Chibok of those young women took place about 30 miles from where I work on the Nigerian side of the border. And I've been working with topics that seemed archaeologically, I mean, looking at them in the past, that seemed to have echoes in the way that Boko Haram operates. Things like slave raiding, for example, that the kidnapping of those schoolgirls was very much like a historical slave raid. And so I was seeing those kind of connections with work that I've been doing for decades in the area. And most unfortunately, I work right there. And so it was because of that that I decided to write the book.
You said you've been going back for 35 years. Do you feel danger when you're there?
No, I mean, if I was in a situation where I felt danger, I wouldn't go. I mean, and, you know, the last time I was in the region was 2014, and we moved in that case because Boko Haram was operating in the area that I work in. That I don't want to put the people I work with in danger, either the people who come with me into the field or the folks in the communities that I live and work in, and both of those things would be possible.
And when you say your work in the field, what is it that you are doing when you're spending time in Africa? Are you interviewing people as a journalist might? Are you just sitting and watching and taking notes?
Well, as an archaeologist, I do some of that. I do some ethnographic work, so just living in communities and interacting with people and observing how things work. I also do spend an awful lot of time just digging up archaeological sites, and it's an extraordinarily rich area archaeologically. So mostly when I'm over there, I'm doing straightforward archaeological field work.
Okay, so digs.
Yes, digs.
Okay, so Nadia, I'm so interested that you are looking at refugees, mental health, and humanitarianism. What an interesting time and I'm sure also discouraging time to be doing the work that you're doing.
It really is. I mean, according to the UN, displacement is at an all-time global historical high. So it is unfortunately a really timely time to be doing the work that I do. And I'm working on two projects. The older one is, which was my dissertation project, is with Iraqi refugees from the Iraq War and the violence that came afterwards who had fled to Cairo, Egypt. And we're living there for years as refugees. And when people think about refugees, they often think about people in these really large camps in various parts of the world. But actually, many refugees are urban refugees. They live in cities, and they have various kinds of rights and abilities to live in certain kinds of ways there. And what I did there was I did ethnographic fieldwork. So I volunteered at an organization that worked with refugees. I interviewed lots and lots of people, about 120 refugees. I visited them in their homes. I spent time with them. I lived in Cairo for more than a year, and I've been going back repeatedly ever since. It's one of the hallmarks of anthropological research, whether the field is somewhere far away or, in fact, in one's own community, is this long-term engagement.
What are you hoping to learn by interviewing the refugees that we may not know just because a human understanding?
Yeah, that's a really, really great question. So a lot of the, there's a lot of anthropological research on refugees, but one of the things I'm particularly interested in are humanitarian solutions, so-called, to displacement. So when people are displaced in their millions or even in smaller numbers, like what is the solution to that? What can happen? And a lot of the research that comes from a more policy angle on solutions focuses on questions of like how many people can a state take? How can people be integrated? Things like that. But an anthropological perspective, and what I've been trying to do, is understand what that's actually like for people who are living as refugees, what their experience is like. And the average refugee, I think, is displaced for about 20 years. So that's a huge portion of a human life. And their experience living in that sort of limbo period, waiting to find out how will they rebuild their life, what will they do. First of all, it has tremendous mental health effects. But it also just, it's a really important kind of human experience, and that's what I think anthropology can bring, is the attention to that.
Cindy, your work, much of it's close to home. You have a project right here in Maine.
I do.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, so I have worked in the past in Sweden and Scandinavian contexts, and found a project that I found really intriguing here in Maine. I'm from away, and I moved here about 5 years ago to take the job at UMaine. And one of the first things I noticed was the prevalence of yard sales, flea markets, all sorts of reuse opportunities.
You
in
mean
the state
it's
of
not
Maine.
Like that other places?
You know what? At first, I wasn't sure. I thought, I wasn't entirely sure. But now, actually, I have evidence of that. Yeah, Maine has one of the strongest reuse economies in the United States. And so that, for me, of course, as an anthropologist, raised all sorts of very traditional anthropological questions. How can we explain this from a cultural standpoint? Is this a reaction to kind of economic precarity, or is there something more cultural here, something about meaning and history? And so, yes, that's what I've been doing. I have a new project that's all about Maine's reuse economy and its potential to maybe lead to more sustainable societies, but also economic savings and maybe even social benefit.
Do anthropologists have a theory like other scientists when you're coming at this question saying, why does Maine have such a strong reuse economy? Do you have a theory about why that is, that you are looking to see if that's true?
Yeah, we're in the early stages of the project, so we have lots of theories.
Okay.
But yes, I think we all kind of have a set of theoretical frameworks that we work within, and they can be quite broad in anthropology, as you might imagine. But if we think about all of the four subdisciplines and what we have in common, most of us are interested in issues of social change. So how do societies organize themselves? How do they respond to new information, new environments? And this reuse project is along those lines as well. One of the things I think is so interesting about it is that we're hearing from a lot of the environmentalist groups and ecological economists that reuse and the extension of product lifetimes is one of the most effective things we can do to protect the environment. But there are also these really interesting ideas here in Maine about our geography being a little more geographically marginal, also at times having some economic precarity that might have also helped to formulate this strong reuse economy.
Okay, well, guess what? We have to go to a break. If you'd like to join the conversation about anthropology, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does New England Rehabilitation Hospital of Portland, helping patients and their families after illness or injury. Learn more at nerhp.org.
European foreign ministers are meeting with Iran to discuss ways to preserve the Iran nuclear deal.
Although now the United States has said that they no longer wish to be part of this deal, we, the European Union, want to see this deal go forward. We want to see it implemented fully, which prevents Iran from ever obtaining nuclear weapons.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Renewed diplomatic efforts amid threats of U.S. sanctions this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening here on Maine Public Radio. This is it, this week. The high school quiz show, Maine determines the state champ. Both Falmouth and Bangor won their semifinal contest, and they now move on to the final event, this Thursday at 8 o'clock on Maine Public Television. The top Maine team will then head down to Boston to compete in the regional finals, which will also broadcast on Maine Public Television. You can watch the Maine State High School Quiz Show Championship this Thursday evening at 8 on Maine Public Television, as the top two teams in the state answer questions about Maine, science, current events, history, math, popular culture, and various other academic topics.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Anthropology in Our Daily Lives. Joining me today, Cindy Eisenhower. She is Assistant Professor in the Department of Anthropology and Climate Change Institute at the University of Maine. Nadia El-Sharawi, am I pronouncing it anywhere near close? Okay, Assistant Professor of Global Studies at Colby College. She teaches classes on cultural anthropology, refugees, refugee policy, global health, and the ethics and politics of humanitarianism. And Scott McEachern is with the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Bowdoin College. His new book is Searching for Boko Haram, A History of Violence in Central Africa. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Sarah Loudon. She's a PhD student at the University of Maine in the Anthropology and Environmental Policy Program. Hi, Sarah. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Tell us about your research.
Sure, and I should say that I'm one of Cindy Eisenhower's students, and I am from Tucson, Arizona, so I'm from the Southern Borderlands region, and my research looks at the social dimensions of conservation of shared rivers, so rivers that are flowing across the border from Arizona into Mexico or Mexico into Arizona. And one of the things that I'm trying to understand are these really complex relationships that relate to water management across the international line, and trying to understand different value systems and diverse ways that we relate to nature and to conservation and restoration.
How is your work received when you talk to those, you know, government policy makers, people in the agricultural sector, the kind of people who have a real interest in water issues?
Well, I think they recognize the need for anthropologists right now because they recognize that environmental crises have at its root the social dimension. So trying to build bridges and collaborative partnerships across the border, because what happens to the water resources in Arizona will affect Mexico and vice versa. So building these bridges can help create more resilient communities, can help create collaborative cross-border partnerships to restore these shared waterways and create sustainable futures.
So, Sarah, how do anthropologists like you communicate what you're researching to the public?
Well, one way, I'll put a little plug, is to collaborate, for example, with artists or humanitarian groups. And there's actually a photography exhibit right now at the Hudson Museum at the University of Maine. It'll be there through the end of June. And it's a black and white photography exhibit that looks at this current migration from Central America and Mexico north through the objects that are left behind. So it's not trying to push a political agenda, but it's allowing people who visit the exhibit to gain knowledge about the migration through the stories of these objects.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling in, Sarah, and good luck with your research. Sarah Loudon, a student in the Anthropology and Environmental Policy Program at UMaine. I'm going to move to Bob, who's calling from Pemaquid. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, thanks, and what a great conversation. I think one of the slightly more rare individuals who actually studied anthropology as an undergraduate, At least that's my perception. I don't run into a lot of people who have done that. But where the field really took me eventually was into the anthropology of organizations, and kind of the anthropologist in me eventually got married to the discipline of organization psychology. And that, for me, has been just a beautiful 30-year career. And, you know, 30 years later, I'm still relying on the basic ethnography and the ability to discern and articulate patterns of thought and behavior with clients all over the world that I really kind of first learned as an undergraduate. And I just find it to be an incredible discipline. And I can't tell you the number of young people who I've encouraged to look seriously at anthropology as a great discipline of study to become a good integrative holistic thinker.
Bob, you talk about your career. Did you do a career in academia, or did you work with corporations? What have you been doing?
No, I really work with corporations and organizations. My biggest client over the years really has been the many agencies affiliated with the UN. But I really depend on. I would say I'm not. I don't have the chutzpah or whatever it takes to be an academic. But I depend heavily on the good work of academics to kind of bridge theory with practice.
Scott,
I think that's fantastic, and I think it illustrates the role that anthropology plays, not just in academia, because everyone always expects to find us in universities and colleges. But in fact, we, as with Bob, we have a real role in organizations, in the commercial world. My students from Bowdoin in anthropology, a number of them have been hired in tech companies. I have students who are at Facebook, at Google, and so on, because those skills, those analytical skills, understanding people, turns out to be important. In my own subdiscipline, archaeology, 75% of the archaeologists in the United States at this point work in the private sector.
Bob, thanks so much for your call. Where would an archaeologist work that's in the private sector?
Mostly doing things like environmental impact assessments for any time you have a road built, any time you have any sort of construction project on a large scale. There's state and federal laws about doing archaeological research beforehand. People don't know this, but the biggest archaeological project in the Northeast in the last 50 years has been the Big Dig.
Oh, I'm not surprised.
Yeah,
sure.
It was immense, you know. So.
Yeah. Okay. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. You can send us an email. Please make it brief. talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet @MaineCalling or post to our Facebook page. Earlier, I asked you all to talk about some of your research, and I know that, Nadia, you said my older project is. What is your newer project? What else are you working on?
Well, the newer project actually is a collaborative project with another Maine anthropologist, Maple Raza, who's also at Colby College, and he's a scholar of social movements in the former Yugoslavia. And when speaking of the ways in which anthropology can engage with contemporary issues, when the European refugee crisis in 2015-2016 was happening, and over a million people took this land route, they started in the water crossing the Aegean Sea from Turkey to Greece, and then they took the land route up through the former Yugoslavia to try and get to mostly Germany, but northern Western Europe more generally, we realized that actually many of the types of people that I had worked with in the Middle East were coming into contact with many of the types of activists that Maple had worked with in the former Yugoslavia. And so from there, we put together this collaborative project that's looking at the migration routes that people took to reach northern and western Europe, and looking at the ways in which European activists tried to enable refugees and migrants to actually make those journeys in various kinds of ways, and the ways in which people themselves find their way when they're moving. So so that's the new project, which I'm very excited about, and has involved moving away a little bit from that traditional anthropological fieldwork where you go and you live in a place and you learn the language and you really sort of embed yourself there, to what we call multi-sited ethnographic fieldwork, where you're looking at multiple sites and spending time in each, but by necessity slightly less time, and understanding the connections between them.
All right. Well, Cindy, I asked you about your reuse project here, but you're working on a couple other projects as well, right?
Yes, I have. I like to think about my work as spanning multiple scales. So the reuse project is really my local project. But I also have been working for the past few years on a statewide kind of regional, New England-based project on waste management. So waste to me has always been a really interesting phenomenon because we can think about it in really different ways. So what's waste to one person can be a really valuable resource to another person. And we see a lot of that in Maine and New England where, you know, we're referred to as kind of the attic of America, right? And so we've been working with a wide variety of stakeholders. So waste managers, with municipal planners, residents, tribal communities, to think about how we can get to a more sustainable waste management system in New England. So that's one project, and to think about how managing waste more effectively can also reduce climate impacts. So it can be a pretty effective mitigation strategy.
So how is waste and waste management anthropology?
That's a good question. Well, there's certainly the question about how we define waste and how is that culturally constructed, right? So here in the United States, we're known as being kind of a throwaway society. We use a lot of disposable products. And at what point in history and why did we come to associate many of the things that have value that are nature, right? Our shoes are embedded nature. Our shoes are embedded energy. But we can very easily transfer those into ideas about waste. So It's kind of this idea of cultural construction and tearing that apart from a historical perspective. But then in a more contemporary perspective, we also need to think about cultural change, right? So if we find information or learn that maybe our societies are not very well adapted to a contemporary environment, how do people take in that information? How do they attempt to change both as individuals and then also as societies? And so I'm really interested in not only social movements around sustainability, but also how we as societies collaborate and work together to try to solve these problems that can really, endanger our future.
Sounds like a lot of overlap with sociology and psychology as well.
Yeah, certainly so. I think, all of the social sciences do certainly have overlap. Anthropology's hallmark has always been this really deep kind of engagement with meaning and with experience, as Nadia was referring to. And also to think a little bit more deeply about the societal connections rather than psychology, which tends to be a very individualistic discipline, to think about how what we do as individuals is fundamentally shaped, and even what we can imagine is shaped by the way that we're enculturated and by our ties to other people.
Scott, you were talking about, well, obviously, your new book about Boko Haram. What other kind of work are you doing in Central Africa?
Well, what I look at archaeologically is the origin of states in Central Africa. I look at state formation, and that which is has deep, deep roots in that area back at least 2,500 years. I do that. I look at, I have an interest in, again, in this sort of more commercial form of archaeology, I suppose, in cultural heritage management and how development projects in Africa and resource projects in Africa, modern projects, can impact the archaeological record. So one thing I do, for example, is I work with the World Bank in determining, in sort of defining how World Bank managers have to control archaeology on World Bank projects in different parts of the world.
I'm interested in what you're talking about, the emergence of states in Africa. How will something you find on archaeological digs or things that you find on an archaeological dig inform you about the formation of a state? What might you find? I mean, obviously, other than a tablet with some sort of writing on it, but what have you found that you have learned from and has helped your scholarship?
Well, the obvious thing would be if you start like a palace, for example, would probably do it. You know, you might, okay, we have a state in that case. In the area that I work in, the two things that I can think of most definitely, immediately are, first, when do people start building walls around towns? That's the sort of defensive features that communities will build if warfare is becoming important. The other thing is actually horses. Because in the area I work, as in the Middle Ages in Europe, horses were really important political and military instruments. And when we start finding horses carefully buried in the archaeological record, we can actually say something about how elite people were thinking about horses. And we've found horses on a number of archaeological sites, including some horses, these poor old horses with hip dysplasia that could never actually be ridden, but they were such, they were status symbols. And so they were kept very carefully by their owners. And we can tell that from the skeletons of the horses.
You can tell that they were cared for, even though they were decrepit.
Yes, exactly. You know, and so that's the sort of evidence that one might not think of immediately when you're thinking about looking at the origins of power and military power in the archaeological record. But it actually does tell us something.
Are horses still a part of the culture where you're
studying? Yes. And they were very much even a military force up until the end of the 19th century. It's still fairly common to see high-status individuals will own a couple of horses and periodically will ride them, even though mostly they spend their times in their Mercedes now or something like that.
Talking about anthropology on Maine Calling today, what are your questions about anthropology? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communication systems. NorrisInc.com. And Green Lion Gallery in downtown Bath, committed to making original art available to all. Shows, classes, and events at greenlionart.com. And Algonquin Playhouse with Smokey Joe's Cafe, featuring dozens of rock and roll's greatest hits now through June 9th. AlgonquinPlayhouse.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Michael Pollan. He's best known for his books about food, but his new book is about the history of psychedelic drugs and current experiments with psychedelics in therapeutic settings to treat depression, fear of death, and addiction. The book also recounts Pollan's own recent personal experiments with LSD and psilocybin. Join us.
That's tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. And at 2 o'clock for the public affairs programming, it's Commonwealth Club of California. Former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, author of Fascism, A Warning, will be the guest. Again, that's 2 o'clock this afternoon here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, learning about the work of anthropologists. Joining me today, three Maine anthropologists. Scott McEachern is with Bowdoin College. Nadia El Sharari is with Colby College. And Cindy Eisenhower is with the University of Maine. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Our caller before the break talked about his work with corporations. Scott, you've talked about your work with World Bank. Cindy, what are some other ways that anthropologists are part of the private sector today?
Yeah, so we're seeing, I think that there is a perception that anthropologists are just in academia, but we have graduates that are all over the place. And I think some of the skills of the anthropological perspective are really useful in a wide array of different disciplines. And in the private sector as well, we're seeing today a lot of anthropologists being hired as diversity officers in organizations who have begun to realize the importance that a really diverse workplace brings to productivity and to general satisfaction. So we see a lot of folks working in that area. And I was thinking about, before I came on the show, some of our most famous anthropologists today. And we see many of them in really high-profile leadership positions in, for example, the World Bank and in the NGO sector, development sector, so like Paul Farmer and Partners in Health. So the anthropological perspective has really kind of diffused into many different areas, not just in academia.
We'll go to Abby, who's calling from Searsmont. Hi, Abby. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I had an anthropology professor at the University of Maine. His name was Sandy Ives. And he did a lot. He went around like John Hammond, and he recorded the songs and the folk tales of the people that used to work, like, in the lumber industry and other industries, paper mills and stuff, and preserved that. And I was wondering if your people remember him. He also brought us Bert and I.
Thanks, Abby.
This is Cindy. I did not unfortunately have the chance to meet Sandy, but he's quite a legend around UMaine. And his legacy, of course, survives. There is a Maine Folklife Center at the university that is still active and under the direction of now of Craig Ettinger. And they're doing great work. They're still out there doing that, recording stories and gaining insight into the history and contemporary livelihoods of Mainers.
Thanks, Abby, for your call. An email from Jean. I've heard the statement, quote, if my life has no meaning or value, then I will behave in a way to cause your life to have no meaning or value. Where does this idea come from? Is this a theoretical idea that has been proven? You guys ever heard that?
I've never heard it. I mean, it's there's one of the things that one of the elements of anthropological research is, you know, the necessity of starting to appreciate other people's worldviews, whether or not you personally agree with them, whether or not in some cases they conflict or they don't conflict with your own value system. But, you know, there's an analytical necessity in figuring out how other people think and figuring out how they understand the world. And sometimes anthropologists are accused of having a sort of a value-free view of societies all over the world, which is not actually the case. But the analytical part of our work demands that we try and get inside the ways that other societies think about the world.
This tweet is related. Can the guests use their training to offer insights into why we live in such partisan times and what might be some ways to lessen the vitriol? Nadia, you're on.
Oh, that's a tough question. I mean, I think what I would do is agree with Scott, right, that this attention to meaning and to being able to see where others come from is absolutely essential to it doesn't mean that you have to accept where other people are coming from. It doesn't mean you have to accept what they say necessarily. That's not, I think, what anthropology would do, but that in order to have any sense, really, of how other people live in the world, you have to sort of see where they're coming from. And I think in that way, this is not at all to deflect from the question of vitriol, which is a really important one, and the sort of challenging times that we do, I think, live in. I think that anthropology, in a lot of ways, is a very hopeful discipline in that anthropologists do study violence. They do study some of the worst things in the world. And my work is all about conflict and the ways in which people try and live and recover from that. And one of the things that I see, if I can offer something hopeful in my from my own research, is the ways in which people recover and work to recover and cope from those really difficult life experiences that sometimes are, feel very hard to recover from. And I think that anthropology, with the attention to the ways in which people can live differently, offers us that hope that we ourselves also can live differently. And so perhaps offer us an avenue, at least, into thinking of a way in which we can push past these sort of really contentious moments and dangerous moments that we're living in.
I have an email from Cynthia. I studied cultural anthropology when the world was young, and my observations concerning the reuse economy follow. As a New York expat, I was astonished to find that while Mainers are wonderful, their systems are less so. I don't know whether the drive to reuse is cause or effect, but I would have to say that without a reasonable way to dispose of goods that no longer serve a purpose, a tag sale offers a win-win solution. Personally, I prefer that to the too often used alternative of dumping garbage in the woods.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I think that there are a lot of different ways to look at Maine's reuse economy, and that's certainly one of them. We are exploring multiple explanations and theoretical frameworks right now, but certainly, yes, lack of other disposal options, lack of access to new products, these kind of economic explanations are certainly there. But we're finding much more than that as well. We're finding a love of reuse, even when there is no economic necessity. We're finding an attachment to things and to history and place-based associations associated with things that people are really excited about. And I was amazed the first time we did an analysis of all of our transcripts and did what we call a word cloud, where you can just see the frequency of word use and to see how often love and interesting, exciting, the thrill of the find, these types of things came up. And also to see a complete lack of stigma associated with reuse for a lot of people here in Maine that we don't see replicated in other areas. So I think that while those economic explanations certainly have some weight, I think there's a lot more there here in Maine, and I'm really looking forward to hearing more people's ideas about.
It's interesting you talk about the lack of stigma. I would almost say not just a lack of stigma, but almost a pride.
It's like a valorization of being ingenuitive and being self-sufficient, and it's really interesting. Yeah, and again, I've read a lot of studies of secondhand cultures in other places, and we don't see that replicated everywhere. So there's something unique here.
Interesting. Take some eyes from the outside to notice that and to see that we aren't the same as everyone else.
Yeah, everybody has culture. And that's something that we work really hard to teach our introductory students, right? It's not just those exotic others that have culture. We all do.
And just for the record, both Scott and Nadia are nodding as she says that. Liz on Facebook writes, I thought your listeners would be interested to know about the work of Dr. James Acheson, who is a professor of anthropology of the University of Maine for over 40 years. He's a cultural economic anthropologist who has studied how people use natural resources in industries such as forest and marine fisheries. One of his seminal works, The Lobster Gangs of Maine, is a great read and gives a lot of insight into how Maine lobstermen have maintained the resource through collaboration and self-regulation. Scott, you're over there nodding.
I love that book. I'm just nodding at that.
So, and our producer, Jonathan, wants me to ask about how anthropology impacts our daily lives, and that would be an example, correct?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Of course.
Yeah, if I could pick up on that one really quickly, I think Jim's work was really very important. Not just for those that are interested in lobstering and lobstering communities here in Maine, but he was really informed a whole body of work that was about how local people can work together and to manage their natural resources without privatization or without the need for centralized government control. And that work was really influential. It helped to inform Eleanor Ostrom's work on common pool resource theory that was Nobel winning. So it can do much more than we oftentimes think.
Mark writes in an email, what are the guests' thoughts on human terrain systems, HTS efforts, during the Iraq and Afghan wars and the controversy around them? Also, do they think similar efforts are ongoing in social media companies today with the rise of big data? For example, Facebook and Cambridge Analytical data breaches. The general issue is the nefarious sides of anthropology or social science. Scott, why don't you start by explaining to us what the human terrain system or HTS efforts are?
HTS, human terrain systems efforts, were undertaken in the context of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And they were efforts that were, in a sense, directed towards putting anthropology to the use of the military. And they did not work out very well, in my opinion, in part because they were, for a number of reasons. One is because they didn't take any account of the fact that anthropologists really have an ethical commitment to the people that we work with. And that is as important as it would be in any discipline. They also didn't work very well because anthropology, as I think we've established here, takes a lot of background work. And just parachuting an anthropologist in with the military unit in Afghanistan, for example, wasn't going to do anything good. And it turned out, in fact, not to do anything good. We certainly do. The other side of this, as I said, some of my students are working for tech companies like Facebook at this point. And it's quite true as well that these sorts of understandings misused can have really negative consequences, as we did see with Cambridge Analytica, for example.
All right. One thing that strikes me, not necessarily about the human terrain systems, but about the conversation we've had for the last hour, is how in one way or another, each of your work seems to be connected with the environment. So even though you're studying humans and human societies, we're also talking about the environment and environmental changes. Scott, are you seeing that in Central Africa?
Oh, very much. I mean, if I take a look, for example, at refugee flows, as Nadia was talking about. In Central Africa, they're often associated with, there's a huge lake in Lake Chad in the area that I work in, and the expansion and contraction of Lake Chad actually generates refugee flows in all kinds of different, localized regional refugee flows in different directions. Some of these folks do end up crossing the Sahara to North Africa, but that has also actually really impacted the struggle against Boko Haram. Boko Haram makes use of those refugees flows in the furtherance of terrorist activities.
And you, Cindy, are studying how people work together or don't work together to address environmental issues, correct?
Right, yeah. I'm really thinking about some of the challenges that we face with climate change and with resource depletion. So I'm really interested in these production, consumption, disposal flows. And, how do we understand those problems? And then how do we react to them, either through policy or through international behavior, individual behavior or social movements? Yeah, and, that's the core of my work.
And, Nadia, I know the refugees you're working with are not what we call climate refugees, but this is a really big issue that everyone in your field is paying attention to, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Scott said it really nicely. And I think the only thing I would add to what he said is that we don't have the same kind of legal protections in place for people who are displaced as a result of climate. So this is absolutely an issue that requires much more study and much more attention to it.
All right. So I think we have time for one more call. We'll go to Margaret, who's calling from Orland. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, thinking about reusing, and it is a tradition up here in Maine, at least with the old timers. A lot of new timers coming in, I think, are people that throw things away much more readily. But I'm also thinking about during the Depression. I was born in 1933. My mother, even though my father was a doctor, we reused everything. And she was really clever at how to repurpose things. People would take sheets that were worn and tear them down the middle and then sew the sides up together. They would take a grandfather's overcoat and cut it down for a child. You know, that was all going on. And then the Second World War came along, and we had to make do because, you know, consumer products just weren't out there. Everything was going into the war effort.
Margaret, thank you. And Cindy, what's interesting, though, because I think what Margaret's talking about was shared experience for all of the United States, but you still are pretty certain something different is going on here in Maine.
I think so. I really do. We have a lot more work to do to parse that all out. And one thing I would say is that we do see some changes in generations, but we are seeing a shift in behavior rather than a lack of behavior. So we're seeing people using online platforms much more often, peer-to-peer exchanges, just in different forms. So Facebook Marketplace or Facebook swaps or Uncle Henry's or Craigslist. So it's still happening, just in a different format.
Margaret, thanks so much for your call. And that will be the last call this hour. What an interesting hour. And thank you all for being here. The voice you just heard, Cindy Eisenhower, who's an assistant professor at the University of Maine's Department of Anthropology and Climate Change Institute. Nadia El-Sharari is an assistant professor of global studies at Colby College. She's a cultural and medical anthropologist whose research focuses on refugees, mental health, and humanitarianism in the Middle East and North Africa and Europe. Scott McEckern, formerly with Bowdoin College, he's about to begin a new adventure in China. How exciting! You'll be joining the faculty of Duke University and Wuhan University. Your new book, Searching for Boko Haram, A History of Violence in Central Africa. When do you move?
Middle of July.
Oh, wow. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, two former American diplomats discuss current international affairs. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.